Chapter 15. The State's Chain.
Wednesday morning, Solicitor Dorsey began to forge his chain of circumstantial evidence around the prisoner. R.P. Barrett, a machinist employed in the metal room where Mary Fagan was employed, told of his finding blood spots near the water cooler in this room, and several strands of hair wrapped around the hands of a lathe several feet away. He said that the spots were smeared over with a white substance known as haskoline, which is used on an eyelet machine. He found a broom nearby, which he said from its appearance looked as if it had been used to spread the fluid over the floor and conceal the blood. This was one of the most vital bits of testimony introduced by the state. On it, the whole theory of the murder was based. That Frank enticed his victim back into the metal room when she entered his office to get her pay, and killed her when she refused to submit to his abuse. Barrett was later corroborated by James Conley, who said he dropped the body of the little girl on the spot where blood was found when he carried her from the second floor to the basement at Frank's direction. Barrett also told of finding a portion of a pay envelope on the floor on the Monday morning after the murder. His testimony was vigorously attacked by the defense when it opened its case, and by attorneys Rosser and Arnold in their closing argument. They sought to show that he was over-anxious to find evidence. Attorney Arnold referred to him as Christopher Columbus Barrett. His story was unshaken, however, and apparently was believed by the jury. Sergeant L. S. Dobbs, one of the party which was first led to the dead girl's side on the morning of the discovery of the body, told of the marks of dragging on the basement floor. The defense sought to show on cross-examination that the distinct track did not begin at the elevator, but a few feet away at the bottom of the ladder leading from the scuttle hole in the first floor. Sergeant Dobbs' testimony was to the effect that indications of the dragging of the body began at the side of the elevator pit. City Detective J. N. Starnes, formal prosecutor of the case, was called by the solicitor to testify to many important facts regarding the investigation of the city police. He told of Newt Lee's reenacting in pantomime the discovery of the body, and declared that he was satisfied that the story told of the discovery of the body by the Negro was true. The sleuth testified that on the morning after the discovery of the body, Frank walked into the office of the pencil factory and remarked to General Manager Darley, "You see, I've got another suit." This remark, the witness testified, was later viewed by the police as significant, inasmuch as the prisoner, who was at that time not suspected of the murder, called attention to a change of clothes on the day following the killing. Starnes testified that on Sunday morning, Frank was nervous and trembly. He also described the blood spots on the floor of the metal room and swore that 50 feet from the elevator he found more blood on the head of a nail. He identified the chips containing the alleged blood spots, which had been chiseled up from the floor. Frequent wrangles marked the first few days of the case. Legal points were constantly under debate. And several times during the first week, as well as later in the trial, the jury was excused. One of those wrangles occurred on the afternoon of Tuesday, July 29th. Solicitor Dorsey sought to introduce in evidence a diagram of the pencil factory bearing a dotted line showing the route Conley asserted he took in carrying the body from the metal room to the basement. The defense strenuously objected to the introduction of this in evidence, complaining principally about the key explaining the drawing. For an hour, the four lawyers addressed the court for and against the introduction of this in evidence. It finally was allowed after the objectionable key had been removed. Wednesday, Boots Rogers declared that Frank was extremely nervous on the morning of April 27th when he drove to his home in an automobile with City Detective John Black to bring the superintendent to the scene of the crime. He said that Frank rubbed his hands continually, paced the floor anxiously, and asked abrupt questions. The state sought to prove that Frank avoided looking on the face of the dead girl at the undertaking parlor. Rogers testified that the superintendent, when he arrived at the undertaking parlor, passed on through the room in which the body lay into another. He could not swear positively, however, that Frank did not see the corpse. Other witnesses called by the state corroborated Rogers. They were contradicted later by Frank in his statement to the jury, the defendant maintaining that he saw the girl's face not only once, but twice, on Sunday, April 27th. Miss Grace Hicks, sister-in-law of Rogers, who first identified the body, told of her trip to the morgue on the morning after the murder. The defense gained a point by an admission from her that the girls in the metal room frequently combed their hair over their machines, and that there was a gas jet a few feet from the lathe on which Barrett discovered the strands of hair supposed to have been Mary Fagan's. The girl also testified that paint was kept in an adjoining room. She said, however, that she had never seen any spilled on the floor of the metal room. City Detective John Black occupied the stand several hours. He was subjected to one of the most merciless grillings of the entire case at the hands of Attorney Rosser. The methods of the police department were held up for criticism and ridicule by the attorney, and once or twice, under the fierce cross-examination, Black appeared confused. Once he admitted that he was muddled as to his facts. Black corroborated Rogers, Starnes, and other witnesses who testified Frank was nervous on the morning he was brought to the undertaking parlor and later to the factory. He also confirmed the testimony of Detective Starnes regarding later investigations of the police. Through him, Solicitor Dorsey brought out the fact that the finding of the bloody club and supposed spots on the floor near the scuttle hole leading to the basement had never been reported to the police by the Pinkerton agency, although the information had been placed in the hands of the defense attorneys. He testified also that Frank and others connected with the pencil factory had withheld from the police the information that Conley could write, although they attempted, the witness declared he believed, to divert suspicion toward others. During the cross-examination, Attorney Rosser asked the detective about the bloody shirt that had been found at Newt Lee's house in a search instituted by the police. Black identified the shirt, which was exhibited to the witness at the request of the defense, as one which he found in the bottom of a barrel at the Negro's home. A stiff legal tilt followed the attempt of the defense to introduce testimony relating to the shirt. Solicitor Dorsey declared to the court that the state contended the shirt was a plant. Later in the trial, he intimated that Frank had gone to the home of the night watchman on the Sunday following the murder and hidden the shirt. Dorsey brought out the point that the blood was on both sides of the shirt in the examination of Black. He contended that it would have been impossible for it to get on the garment in this matter if the garment were worn. Detective Harry Scott of the Pinkerton Agency, which was retained on the case by the pencil factory company at the instigation of Frank, took the stand on the morning of July 31st. He told of his visit to the factory on the Monday after the murder, and of being shown over the factory by the man against whom he later helped to gather evidence. Among other features which the solicitor attempted to prove through his witness was the fact that Frank had attempted to direct suspicion toward Gant. In reply to a question put by the solicitor, the witness replied that Frank had not told him that Gant was acquainted with the murdered girl when he was employed at the factory. Dorsey declared that he had been misled by the witness on this proposition when the defense attorneys objected to his attempting to bring this point out. Attorney Rosser contended that the prosecutor would have to declare to the court that he had been entrapped by the witness before he could pursue this line of questioning. Dorsey refused to make the allegation, but was later allowed to put the queries. The intimation that he had been guilty of reticence brought a sharp retort from Detective Scott. From the stand, he demanded to know of the solicitor if he thought he was holding back information. The state's representative declared that he did not, but contended that the detective had forgotten this detail. He then asked Scott, "Was any suggestion made to you, subsequent to your employment, about the withholding of evidence?" Scott replied, "About the first week in May, Mr. Pierce and I went to the office of Herbert J. Haas, attorney for Frank, to hold a conference relative to the Pinkertons' position in the investigation. I told him that there was a strong suspicion against Frank." The last sentence was ruled out. After a conversation, Mr. Haas said that he would rather we would submit our reports to him before we did to the police. We told him we would get out of the case before we would do that. Thursday afternoon, the fourth day of the trial, several surprises were sprung. Mel Stanford, a youthful employee of the factory, testified that he had swept the floor of the metal room on the Friday preceding the murder, and that the blood spots, nor Haskellene, were on the floor then. He said that he had seen spots of various colors on the floor of the factory at different times, but that never had he seen one of the same color and appearance as those presumed to have been the blood of Mary Fagan on the floor of the metal room. A vigorous cross-examination at the hands of Luther Z. Rosser failed to shake his statement. Dr. Claude Smith, city bacteriologist, identified the chips taken from the floor of the metal room and declared that on one of them he had discovered blood corpuscles. The defense brought out in cross-examining him that the corpuscles could have been there for several months or possibly several years if not disturbed. William A. Gessling, embalmer employed at the parlor of P.J. Bloomfield, declared that Mary Fagan had been dead from 12 to 15 hours when he removed her body from its hiding place in the pencil factory basement. The blood had settled, and rigor mortis had begun. He told of embalming the remains, and of examinations of the wounds on the body he had made. E.F. Holloway, day watchman at the factory, was accused by the solicitor of having entrapped him when he testified that he had left the switch box which controlled the motor of the elevator unlocked on the day of the murder. This was in direct contradiction to the state's theory of the murder. Solicitor Dorsey's contention was that after Frank had called Conley to help him dispose of the body, he went to the office and got the key of the receptacle before he could start the machinery. Holloway declared that he had left the building about noon Saturday, and that he used the motor, which also was geared to a circular saw, to cut two boards for Arthur White and Denham, who were working on the fourth floor of the factory. He said that after he had finished this work, he placed the boards on the elevator and started it to the fourth floor. Solicitor Dorsey produced an affidavit made several weeks before by the witness in the presence of several people. In this document, Holloway declared that he had left the elevator locked when he started for home. The witness did not deny the affidavit, but he declared at the time of making it he had forgotten sawing the planks. Deeper consideration of the matter had caused him to remember the incident, he asserted. "Didn't you tell a Pinkerton detective on May 9th to come around next day and he might find some evidence?" was one of the many questions asked this witness by the solicitor. "I did not," was the reply. On May 10th, Detective McWorth of the Pinkertons found the alleged blood spots, the bludgeon, and several pieces of cord similar to the one by which the little girl was strangled. Dorsey intimated that Holloway might be able to shed some light on how these things came there, inasmuch as the state contended that this evidence also was planted for the purpose of diverting suspicion from Frank. "Didn't you once boast that Conley was your nigger?" asked the solicitor. The witness denied that he ever had. Mrs. Arthur White, who took the stand on Friday, August 1st, declared that she had entered the building to see her husband at 11:30 a.m., and after talking to him for a few minutes, left the factory. It was 11:50 when she departed. 30 minutes later, she returned, she said, and entered Frank's office previous to going to the fourth floor, to again see her husband. Frank was bending over the safe in the office when she entered, according to her statement, and appeared startled at her approach. Mrs. White testified that she later went to the fourth floor where her husband and Harry Denham were working. She remained until 12:50 p.m., when Frank appeared on the fourth floor and told her that he was going to lock the building before going to lunch, and that she'd better leave then. She took his suggestion, she said. Her testimony was of vital importance because the state maintained that the murder had been committed between her first and second visits. Mrs. White described Frank's conduct when he came to the fourth floor as natural. The woman also told of seeing a Negro lurking in the shadows in the hallway on the first floor as she was leaving the building. Conley was brought before her, but she could not positively identify him. He answered the same general description, however, she said. General Manager M.V. Darley, called to the stand, admitted that Frank was nervous on the morning of Sunday, April 27th. He said that the superintendent explained it by saying that he'd been called from bed summarily that morning, had come down to the factory before he had an opportunity to drink his usual cup of coffee. Darley said that he, too, had looked at the punches in the time slip made by Newt Lee and had failed to detect the alleged discrepancies in them. It would have been possible for a man who understood the mechanism of the clock to manufacture a slip which could not be detected from the genuine in 5 minutes. Friday afternoon, August 2nd, the defense called Dr. H. F. Harris, Secretary of the State Board of Health, to the stand. He was one of the surprises of the case. Through his testimony, the defense sought to clinch the fact that the little girl never left the factory after entering it. Dr. Harris performed an autopsy on the body when it was exhumed 9 days after the original burial. He had taken portions of the stomach and of the girl's sexual organs and examined them exhaustively. Until the time he took the stand, no intimation of the sensational testimony he was to give had reached the public. He declared that the girl had met death between half and three-quarters of an hour after she ate her noonday meal. He reached this conclusion from the state of the cabbage and other food found in her stomach. Dr. Harris was later corroborated by J.W. Hurt, county physician, and other physicians in Sir rebuttal. The defense sought by the testimony of half a dozen prominent physicians to prove that Dr. Harris was hazarding only a wild guess when he attempted to fix the time of death by this investigation. Others testified, however, that it was not a guess, but a scientific opinion. Of most vital importance was the testimony of Dr. Harris that, although no criminal assault had been committed upon the girl before death, some kind of violence had been done her. This was proven by the state of her organs, he declared. Dr. Harris said that the eye of the victim had been blackened before death, probably by a blow, and that the wound on her head, which he declared undoubtedly produced unconsciousness, was produced by a sharp instrument. It would have been impossible to have inflicted it with the round club found near the elevator pit, he said. Dr. Harris collapsed on the stand in the midst of a grueling cross-examination replete with hypothetical questions at the hands of Attorney Arnold. Saturday afternoon, Dr. Hurt was called and confirmed to a considerable extent the testimony of Dr. Harris. He described the wounds on the body of the girl in detail. On cross-examination, the defense gained admissions by which they sought later to prove that the evidences of alleged assault found by Dr. Harris might have been the result of Dr. Hurt's examination of the corpse immediately after death. Albert McKnight, husband of Manola McKnight, cook in the Salig home, was called to the stand on Saturday, August 2nd. He testified that he had been in the kitchen of the residence on Saturday, April 26, and that Frank entered the dining room and viewed himself in the mirror for a few minutes. His testimony was later attacked by his wife, who repudiated on the stand the sensational affidavit she had previously made to the police. W.F. Anderson, call officer, G.C. February, stenographer in the detective department, chief of police Beavers, Detective Wagoner, Patrolman Lassiter, were also called on Saturday. Their testimony, with the exception of that of Chief Beavers, was largely corroborative of that already introduced. The police department head told of searching the vicinity of the scuttle hole leading to the basement a few days after the murder, and his failure to see the blood, cord, and club later discovered there by Detective McWorth. Miss Helen Ferguson, a factory girl, told the jury of having sought out Frank Friday evening to ask him to give her Mary Fagan's pay envelope. Frank refused to deliver it into her custody, she said. On this day also, which was the last of the first week, the defense protested because Judge Roan had on his desk a newspaper with a large red headline, State Adds Links to Chain. It was the contention of the defense that the paper had unwittingly been exposed to the jury. Immediately after the paper was alleged to have been exposed to the jury, attorneys Rosser, Arnold, and Haas retired from the courtroom to hold a consultation as to what action would be taken. It was thought for a time that a mistrial would be asked. After a conference of 5 minutes, however, the lawyers returned to the courtroom and asked that the jury be excused. After the 12 men had left the room, attorney Rosser took the floor and announced that it was not the intention of the defense to ask a mistrial at that time. Solicitor Dorsey asked that the jury be cautioned against being influenced by anything they had seen or were likely to see in the future. Judge Roan did this when the jury was returned. Several other witnesses were called during the first week of the trial, but their testimony developed nothing that had not already been disclosed in the investigation of the police and private detectives, and was mostly corroborative of important phases of the case.